Vice Chair Gilliam has moved House Bill 4134 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. And I can carry this. That's fine. All right. With that, I'm going to close the work session. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4129.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4129 directs the Oregon State Capitol Foundation to undertake fundraising for commissioning of statues and to have them put at on display in the National Statuary Hall. You have a dash one amendment. It replaces the original measure and directs legislative administrator to administer process for replacement of current statues and production of new statues to be displayed at National Statuary Hall. It creates National Statuary Hall Replacement Fund, separate from general fund, to receive gifts, grants, donations, and other monies for the project. It directs the administrator to use the funds to commission, transport, and unveil sculptures of Chief Joseph, Abigail Scott Dunaway, and Mark Hatfield at the hall. And it requires him to use funds to install statue and pedestal of Chief Joseph in Capitol until Oregon Capitol until Idaho approves placement of Chief Joseph. It also requires him to place and put the statues of McLaughlin and Jason Lee in the Capitol building. It specifies process for coordinating with Idaho for placement of Chief Joseph statue, and I'll just conclude there, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We do not have a revenue. We do not have a fiscal impact on the measure yet. I am awaiting it, and we do have a no revenue impact.
Great, thank you, Representative Clem.
Great, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21 here in Salem, and you can disregard everything that's in the base bill because the dash ones replace everything. And I've got a little one pager here for you that I can walk you through on what these dash ones do. Just for a little background, you may recall the House has twice passed a bill to send Mark Hatfield to Statuary Hall. This is a different approach. The Commission on Statuary Hall that was convened a few years ago met. They narrowed from many, many, many Oregonians down to four. They had an online vote, and then in the end, the Commission voted. And they had four. It was Chief Joseph, Abigail Scott Dunaway, Mark Odom Hatfield, Thomas Lawson McCall. They voted. It was seven for Chief Joseph, six for Abigail Scott Dunaway, five for Mark Odom Hatfield, and one of my heroes, poor Tom McCall, didn't get any votes. And they sent a recommendation then to the last legislature, to their top two vote getters. They unanimously recommended to bring Jason Lee and John McLaughlin home. Then they had this split vote on who the different people might be. And so they sent a bill or a recommendation to the last legislature. I had a bill here to receive that. Senator Courtney had a bill to receive it. The Senate started, heard the testimony of the commission and Senator Courtney and Senator Farioli, passed the bill to Ways and Means where it died. So now we're back to square one, which is Jason Lee and John McLaughlin are there, and this is the only bill this session that I can find that's on this topic. So I've come up with a compromise proposal that I'm hoping will get through better than the last three that we've tried on this topic from different angles. You may recall, if you read in the paper, that part of the controversy that may have resulted in some of the problems with the bill came from the state of Idaho. The governor of Idaho made some public comments and wrote a letter to the state of Oregon talking about the traditional area of the Nez Perce and Chief Joseph, and that gave some people some pause, including some tribes here in Oregon that I've talked to. You say, oh, that's an interesting question. So I'm trying to resolve all of those things in this bill. So here's what the bill does. It asks the legislative administrator to be responsible for the coordination of working with Idaho on the Chief Joseph question, finding artists, getting the statues built. Private money, no public money. Capital Foundation entirely out of this. They have other things they're working on. They don't want to be included. As I'm a member, Representative Huffman is a member, I think Vice Chair Gilliam is a member, they have other things they're working on right now. So legislative administrator would handle the kind of administrative tasks, probably use some kind of committee to help advise on some of these things that he could set up. And I spoke with him yesterday a little bit about this and just waiting final feedback. And the key issue here is we will build all three of the vote getters. Rather than pick, we'll build all three. As the money comes in, they'll build statues. we will, in the bill, work with Idaho. What I'm thinking this looks like is we offer to Idaho, we've now paid for Chief Joseph. We want to place, he was our number one vote getter, we want to place Chief Joseph in Statuary Hall, but we would be willing to let you claim him for 10 years, and then we switch the nameplates, and from then on, he's ours. I don't know if they'll buy this. It seems reasonable. We're paying. So that's what the bill calls for. Work with Idaho to see what we can work out. In the meantime, follow the commission's unanimous recommendation and bring Jason Lee and John McLaughlin home to a prominent place here in the Oregon Capitol. Now, my Marion County Historical Society would actually like to take him out of here and put him across the street at Jason Lee's childhood home, and I think Representative Barton said there's a great place for him in Oregon City. So we could probably negotiate over where those two go, but they need an honored place after their, you know, service in Statuary Hall on our behalf for a long time now. So then what you have is situations, if let's say Chief Joseph is in Idaho for 10 years and McLaughlin and Lee are back here, we can send two. So we can send Mark Hatfield and Abigail Dunaway, and it would be based on who gets built first, and whoever gets built goes, while the Chief Joseph issue is being worked out with Idaho. At any point, at year 11, when we have resolved whether Joseph had his 10 years with Idaho or not, Chief Joseph becomes Oregon's statue, and I would assume Mark Hatfield as the third vote getter comes home at that point and is promptly placed in the Oregon Capitol. So that's what I'm trying to find here, is a win-win for us, Idaho, the commission, the House, the Senate, the governor, and I think we've found a good plan, but you never know. So I'm open to any suggestions or input, but it's I have two bills this session, the Minyasui Day, which passed in this one, so this is now what I'm working on.
Thank you, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Clem, I'm just so appreciative because I could see the subcommittee for the Capitol Foundation having to raise the money, being you, Vic, and me.
That's right.
So thank you.
Excellent. Any other questions for Representative Clem? Gillian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Clem, for bringing this. As folks may know, we've passed a statue bill twice on the House side, and we ran into whatever difficulties getting it heard on the Senate side. And then, as you reported, their Rules Committee acted. This is a delightful, not really a surprise, but a delightful solution. And I want to be sure on record that folks understand there are nearly 2 million visitors to the Statuary Hall in Washington. Our two representatives, Reverend Lee and John McLaughlin, have served us extremely well, telling an important part of Oregon history. It is important that they come home to places of honor and to places where folks in Oregon can enjoy them. And I think this bill has a good plan for that. The three individuals on this bill have an incredible, very different eras, have an incredible Oregon story to tell. And I won't go into their profiles, but I think the commission did great work, including Tom McCall, in narrowing four new stories that can give a fresh narrative about our state to 2 million people a year. That's the significance to me, and this is a great way. I want to note that we are respecting Idaho, but I want to remind folks, the federal law says it is up to the legislature of each state. So reaching out this way to Idaho, I think, is great. I don't know what their plan is. I don't know if they have a plan. But the chief was a huge figure in the Northwest, period. And I don't know if I've ever mentioned this. I think Mark Hatfield has a huge impact on the Northwest and our nation as well. And Abigail Scott Dunaway, what she did for bringing appropriate, just rights for women in our state, when she did it, is an incredible story. So, again, I thank you for bringing this forward. This is not just a dusty old historic statue someplace. This is a great way to tell chapters of the Oregon story, both those that are coming home and those that we commission in our nation's capital. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? All right. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4129. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4085. And as Representative Rayfield comes to the mic, I just want to I want to publicly thank the Campaign Finance Task Force for their good work and good faith effort to look at campaign finance reform in our state. And the task force primarily focused on one aspect of campaign finance reform, which was whether or not to impose limits on campaign contributions. But I believe it's only one part of a much larger system that needs to be addressed in a comprehensive manner. If we take on contribution limits to PACs, I think we're creating a huge incentive for funders to move to independent expenditures and move their and put their money into what's called, you know, dark money pots. And those pots of money are nearly impossible to track. So I think that we need a comprehensive approach that truly gets big money out of politics and doesn't inadvertently create a system that's even less transparent than the one we have now. And I believe this approach needs to consider safeguards on independent expenditures and real enforcement tools, contribution limits, and probably even some form of public funding. Right now, the Oregon system trades limits for transparency, and we don't have contribution limits, which means there's not any real reason for independent expenditures to exist in this state. But what we do require is strict disclosure of all contributions and expenditures, and we make it easy to track online for the public. I hope today's hearings and subsequent conversations will be the start of a larger effort to tackle campaign finance reform in a more comprehensive way. And I think it's critical that we do it not in a piecemeal fashion, but I want to challenge Oregon to do this in an Oregon way, to be big and to think bold. Representative Rayfield.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan Rayfield, House District 16. Before I get started, I just want to say what an honor it is to be before your committee today. It's a privilege, so thank you for taking the time. I served on the Campaign Finance Task Force, and one of the things that became apparent, as you mentioned, was that we were very focused on a constitutional amendment that would allow us to place caps on individual contributions. It would also allow us to do various other things that we cannot do currently under the Oregon Constitution. And the idea was to bring us in control in similarities to where the federal Constitution is. One of the problems that was very apparent on this was that, yeah, as you mentioned, Chair, that the other states that have caps on contributions, you start seeing shifts into independent expenditures. And so this was a direction that committee was very interested in. There were several people very interested in, so that got us thinking about, okay, if this is the direction that the state of Oregon may travel down, we need to really look at how are we managing our independent expenditures currently in Oregon. And so that was the initial premise for this bill and started the investigation. So what you see in the bill, and there is going to be a dash two amendment, and that's what I'm going to walk you through. You do not have that in front of you today. It will be out tomorrow. But the first part is what we do is on independent expenditures. First of all, we wanted to make them searchable on ORSTAR, just like you can search any campaign and see the expenditures. So if you wanted to search Dan Rayfield and see what is going, what independent expenditures are going to that campaign, or if you wanted to search Dan Rayfield, where is he spending his independent expenditures, you'll have that flexibility to be able to do that in ORSTAR, again, increasing transparency. The threshold for independent expenditures currently is $750. We wanted to lower that threshold to $250. That's what the Dash 2 amendment will be. We wanted it to be high enough to where we didn't capture the small person, the person who might be, you know, opposed, say, at a city council race where they print up a bunch of flyers and they're out front of Safeway or someplace and they're handing these things out or at their farmer's market. But we also wanted to have the threshold a little bit lower, because what happens in independent expenditures is you may have five or six people that coordinate together, say at $300, six people, and they spend $1,800 on a mailer. And we want to be able to capture that data, which could be very influential. And kind of the example that some of us have seen is in city council races or county commission races, where you have people who are interested in a specific issue, whether it's land use or other things like that, and they all band together to do an independent expenditure to help a specific candidate out. And we want to make sure that we have that, the voters have that information, because it's very helpful for them when they're making decisions. The way that the impact to the individual with the threshold would be, you'd have to simply be able to file it online. It's a very easy, not a lot of work put into it to comply with that type of a threshold. We looked at some of the issues, and all the things we're trying to do, also keeping context, is what we're able to do given the current case law in the federal constitution and in Oregon. So the $250 was specifically tailored to match the Oregon's constitution and also the federal limits that have been approved in other case law. There was a $200 limit on independent expenditures that was approved in another state. In that Supreme Court decision, we looked at that, and a lot of the same rationale and the reasons that they approved that $200 applies to the state of Oregon. The other thing that this does is we wanted to be more proactive about monitoring campaign finance. So right now, this is a complaint-driven system. And even in a complaint-driven system, there is not a lot of ability for the Secretary of State to really look into these matters, and it's basically on a trust basis. So what we were going to do is have random audits or reviews and examinations of campaigns, PACs. And so it would be, for instance, for a three-month period of time where they would be able to go, it's kind of like a tax audit, if you will, where they'd be able to audit the records relating to campaign finance. Campaigns are currently allowed to keep campaign their expenditure. They're supposed to be required to keep all of their information for 2 years. The problem that we found in the spot checks that used to be done was we were just checking what people were actually filing. So if I had 10 contributions come in, we just check to make sure those contributions are accurate. We're not checking for the absence of something. So this would allow the Secretary of State's office to gather, say, 2 months of bank statements and confirm that that is what's going on in ORSTAR. The other thing that it would do is spot checks on independent expenditures, and we would also increase the penalty for right now it's 10%. We would increase the penalty for violating campaign finance reform from 10% to 40% being the maximum. And I believe that is I'm trying to think if there's anything else that we had in the bill, and it looks like I've covered everything.
So. Excellent. Any questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rayfield, the jump from 10 to 40% seems to be quite a jump. How did you... And this is a work group product, is that right, basically?
No, this is not a...
This is just yours. Can you explain the 40%? One thing that concerns me is if this sets a precedent, and I believe bad actors should be punished, absolutely. But sometimes when you're dealing with a lot of contributions, honest mistakes do happen also. I'd be concerned that we were setting a precedent, you know, where that could be carried over into other penalties for innocent mistakes that, you know, 40% of a $10,000 error in any given month starts adding up to money. Just a thought question.
And Chair Williamson, Representative Huffman, that was a lot of thought we put into this at where was the appropriate threshold. What I think was in our office as we looked at 10%, there's really no incentive to comply because it's so minuscule. On $100, you lose $10 on a given transaction. Again, this is something that scales up. So it's and so looking at that, how do we actually work and actually get people to really comply with this? If somebody, and there are always innocent mistakes, there are people on the highway that aren't paying attention to their speedometer and they get caught with a speeding ticket. Right now we have no police on the road actually looking at these things, and there's no bite to anything that we're doing to get compliance. And 40% out of a total contribution is actually, you know, that's a fairly small amount in, you know, in the context of any contribution.
So. Follow up, Madam Chair. And I support this and that. I would just like to go on the record, not that it'll make any difference in the future, but, you know, in this context, I think the 40% is appropriate because you are dealing with, as you state here, smaller defined contributions. I would hate to see this extrapolated into other areas where you are dealing with maybe tens of thousands of dollars, and if somebody wanted to start applying 40%, that could be tougher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question about the work group, if I may. Is that work group still viable, and what are they charged with doing, if they are?
Chair Williamson, Representative Wilson, it depends on how you define viable. I say that in jest, obviously. You weren't smiling. Normally you have a great smile, Representative Wilson. So the work group is ongoing currently and is going to be exploring other things into the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Transparency is important. Accuracy, the penalties, all of that. You don't have to comment on this. Maybe it's a naive comment. But when you mentioned the effect that independent expenditures have on folks deciding how to vote on a candidate or an initiative, is this just gotcha, or is there another side to it which doesn't take away from the transparency? If several folks, organizations, suddenly say, I'm putting $300 in, this guy, this gal is a good one, isn't that also the information can be a positive? Wow, these people stood up, wrote checks. I'm glad I know that XYZ are supportive.
And Chair Williamson, Representative Gilliam, I think you're absolutely right. I think that some people, if they were to coordinate independently of a campaign in support of an individual, that's something that I think could also be helpful for voters. I think often, you know, when we start looking at these things, it's always from the negative, where we've had a bad example, you know, and there are examples in Oregon where we've had folks, especially in local races, on some of these smaller thresholds where they've come together, and that information would have been helpful prior to an election so that the will of the voters is heard.
Any other questions for Representative Rayfield? All right, thank you very much. And I have Norm Trill and Daniel Lukow.
Did we do this one?
You're good. Chair Williamson and members of the committee, my name is Norman Trill. I'm the president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I'm also a member of the Task Force on Campaign Finance Reform, representing the League of Women Voters. And I'm also been working on campaign finance reform issues since the 1970s, and so I know quite a bit about this subject. And besides all that, I'm a retired computer software engineer and analyst, and so I'm not afraid of real deep thinking about subjects such as this. The League of Women Voters is a 96-year-old grassroots and political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League has long-standing positions that support reliable information about political campaign financing as being critical to campaign transparency. Oregon voters adopted campaign contribution limits by initiative in 1994. During the 1996 state campaigns, it became clear that campaign contribution limits would cause independent expenditures to actually increase, and they did during that campaign, at least to some degree. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, the Oregon Supreme Court struck down those contribution limits in the Veneta decision, leaving Oregon voters with campaign finance disclosure as their only protection against high campaign spending, potential corruption, and undue influence. It is now clear that campaign contribution limits, favored by voters by as much as 80% in some opinion polls, will eventually return to Oregon in one form or another. These may be enabled by HJR 205, which we hope to see in this committee soon during this session, or by the recommendations of the constitutional amendment of the Task Force on Campaign Finance Reform to this legislature, or by Initiative Petition 77, which is currently gathering signatures. If the voters adopt one of these reforms, then independent expenditures will be again become a way to circumvent contribution limits, and a bill like HB 4085 will become necessary to discourage independent expenditures. However, the League believes that this bill has significant problems for this purpose at this time. First, the low limit that was in the initial bill of $50, and I hear you saying that this is up to $250 now, that was probably going to invite a lawsuit because it's so low. It's analogous to the federal lawsuit that resulted in $100 contribution limits being declared unconstitutionally low. Secondly, HB 4085 does not get at the real problem. No one really cares about a person spending $50 or $100 on signs or flyers for their neighborhood. What we should really care about are the huge dark money independent expenditures unleashed by the Citizens United case, and I might say by the incompetency of the IRS. And such huge contributions by individuals, so-called social policy nonprofits, corporations, and unions can be very damaging to legitimate campaign, political campaigns. Candidates lose control of their messaging, and voters do not know what to think. Furthermore, many dark money groups do not have to disclose where their money comes from. The League believes that the solution to these problems is not necessarily a lower disclosure limit for independent expenditures, but we should require the disclosure of sources of money used for these expenditures to the same extent as for normal candidate or other political committees. And I've actually put into the record my ideas of what these amendments might look like. Unfortunately, my staff took out the track changes in the Word document, and I'd be happy to supply you with a digital copy of the actual amendments that I'm suggesting if you should want to look at those. Furthermore, requiring disclosure of top contributors in campaign advertising would also discourage independent expenditures. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this legislation.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Daniel Lukow, and I work for Common Cause Oregon. Common Cause Oregon is an organization dedicated to empowering citizens to engage in their democracy. And one of the biggest ways that we can lift up the voices of voters is by reducing the impact of big money in politics. Unfortunately, HB 4085 is problematic and could have unintended consequences. We oppose this bill for two reasons. The first is that it fails to address voters' concerns about money in politics, and the second is that it will make Oregon vulnerable to a costly legal battle and challenge that could have negative national effects on transparency efforts. This bill does not meet the concerns that voters have about big money in politics. Voters are worried about the hundreds of thousands of dollars and potentially millions of dollars that donors can pour into political campaigns. They are worried about the high costs of elections and that their voices are being drowned out by big money. Voters are more concerned about big money than about a couple of grassroots activists who spend $250 on markers and poster board and flyers for a school board race. And that's our main policy concern with this bill, is that of all the pantheon of campaign finance reform issues that we face right now in our elections, is this really, that should $250, $300 really be a priority and what we're focused on? The other problem is that this bill would make Oregon vulnerable to a legal challenge, and that could create unintended consequences. The courts have supported disclosure, as Representative Rayfield noted, but have also stated that reporting requirements can create a burden for citizens to get involved in democracy. The government has to balance whether or not a burden is outweighed by a government interest in transparency. For instance, a $500,000 donation can buy a lot of materials and ads. It will likely have the effect of persuading voters to vote a certain way. And because the large expense can have an impact, the government can, in that case, place disclosure requirements on that amount, even if it is burdensome. That might not be the case with the $250 trigger in this bill. The courts will look for evidence of small expenses influencing elections. They have to have documented evidence about whether $250 independent expenditure has and can sway elections, and not only school board elections, but state elections, judicial elections. So if there's not that evidence, the courts could strike down the laws, placing a burden on small donors who want to get involved in their democracy. And the courts could not only strike down this law, but it could also restrict the ability to pass disclosure laws in the future by narrowing the justification for transparency and reforms. So it's a problem because it's focusing on an issue that voters have not really been bringing to the legislature, and it's a problem because it's very vulnerable to a legal challenge that could not only make sure this law is struck down, but could narrow the justification for transparency laws in the future in Oregon and other states and nationally. HB 4085 is problematic because it creates a barrier for voters to get involved in their democracy. It makes Oregon vulnerable to a legal challenge that could see the law struck down and restrict our ability to pass disclosure reforms in the future. For these reasons, Common Cause Oregon respectfully urges you to not pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Rayfield.
Wait, Common Cause actually was very involved in sending me some emails, and I read through their attorney, and I think he's reciting the $50, the citation. I read through their attorney in all of their cases. One of the cases, for just so the committee feels comfortable with it, their attorney relied upon is there was a $200 limit that was found to be constitutional, and that's what I was referencing in my testimony. So we actually went more conservative, bumped it to 250, even made it a little bit higher, and the circumstances from that case that his attorney was relying upon that was found to be constitutional is the basis for the $250. And with anything you do in campaign finance, and I've run this by Ledge Council, anything you do in the campaign finance world, there is always risk. However, keeping at the $250 level actually is a very low risk because the U.S. Supreme Court has already found in one jurisdiction that to be constitutional.
I think just to clarify, we actually examined the whole breadth of cases from U.S. Supreme Court, Ninth Circuit Court, the Ninth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, and the U.S. Supreme Court held in McIntyre v. Ohio Elections Commission that disclosure could be excused where it only captures the, quote, de minimis spending in elections. This exception still applies after Citizens United, But most recently in the 10th Circuit Court, the 10th Circuit was quite unsympathetic to disclosure law in Colorado, affecting the actions of a few neighbors seeking to fight local annexation. I think you referenced that case. As the courts argued, it is unlikely that the Colorado voters who approved the disclosure requirements were thinking of a couple of neighbors working on a local ballot annexation case. The 9th Circuit has reiterated that in a separate case. So we have the U.S. Supreme Court, the 10th Circuit, and the 9th Circuit all ruling basically that this has to be based on firm evidence that $250 can sway an election and that's problematic and that justifies the burden of speech. So until we have the evidence, I would caution the state to pass this bill because it will most likely be challenged in our court system. And I think we should have the evidence going into that before we pass it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lukow, if I understand correctly, then you're saying that although this idea is well-meaning, it's really not resounding with what folks are really concerned about.
You know, yeah, I mean, I know folks here are here for other bills and legislation. They're really concerned about the high effect of money in politics in terms of independent expenditures, campaign contributions, pass-through donations, and the lack of transparency we have on a lot of those major contributions. And so when they're asking to get big money out of politics, you know, with all due respect to this, I don't think that this is what they're really referring to. I think they're referring to real systemic change.
Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4085, and I'm going to open a public hearing on HJM2.
HJM 2 or 201?
201. I meant 201. 201. Sorry.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, HJM 201 applies to Congress to call an amendment convention for purpose of proposing amendments to the United States Constitution that addresses campaign finance reform. It comes to you today. We do not have the revenue or fiscal impact on the underlying measure.
201.
That's the correct one. That's what I'm here
Sorry,
for, Madam
everyone.
Chair. I don't know about you, but Chair Williamson, committee, John Huffman, state rep for House District 59. A lot of the testimony that I could have given was given by the previous panel talking about the reason that I'm involved in HJM 201, and that's trying to bring some rationale to the money invested in political campaigns. And I do want to say on the record, I appreciate the emails that I've received the last two or three days encouraging support of HJM 201, but I would like to point out that HJM 201 is about more than just corporate personhood. It's about out-of-state billionaires that tend to maybe have the ability on occasion to buy elections in Oregon. It has to do with corporations, it has to do with unions, it has to do with all sorts of, you know, dark money, all sorts of large amounts of money that can be put into campaigns and take away the voice of the person that only has $50 or $100 to contribute to a campaign. So that's why I'm involved in this. It's an Article 5 call for Congress to have an amendment convention specifically narrowly targeted at campaign finance reform. Thank you for your time. Happy to allow my partner in crime here to answer any of your questions, especially the tough ones. And we do have some groups. Last year, we had this. Representative Clem, Representative Hoyle, and I were the chief sponsors on it. And a lot of the session was spent between Wolfpack and Move to Amend to come up with the language that we came up with that you see before you today. So I appreciate all of their hard work, and we do have folks that will testify to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hoyle.
Hi, Val Hoyle, representative from House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City. And for the record, it is Ash Wednesday, hence the ashes. It's when we call it Catholic Coming Out Day. You can tell when all the Catholics, who all the Catholics are in the building. So if you're wondering, that's why. I am here with my good colleague, Representative Huffman, to support HJM 201. And it comes from the need to overturn Citizens United. I think this was one of the worst decisions that has been made recently, in that it allowed unlimited money in politics. I do not believe that corporations are people. I do not believe that money is speech. And we need to find a way to overturn Citizens United, and we've come together in a bipartisan way. There's support from all across the political spectrum to find a way to address this issue. HJM 201 would apply to Congress to call a constitutional convention to amend the United States Constitution to address campaign finance reform. Here in Oregon, we have some of the most expensive legislative races in the country. And at the national level, what we've seen is that since Citizens United, people and organizations who have lots of money have been able to buy the process. And what that does is it makes it so that we silence the voice of ordinary people in the political process. That's wrong, and I see this as one way to address it. And happy to entertain questions or have the next few panels come up to talk to you about why this is important, how this would be very narrowly focused, and hopeful that you would be inclined to support this legislation.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
I've gone back and forth on this concept for several years. I want campaign finance reform as much as anybody. I think the current system that allows the oligarchs to spend unlimited amounts of money to try to influence elections in ways that are destructive of Oregonians and the American people is a catastrophe for our democracy. It's a catastrophe. Other than an invasion, it is probably the worst thing that can happen to us. I'm very worried about this measure. I hope that you and the other people who will testify have good answers to this question. The question really is, how do you, in the lack of any precedent, in the lack of any law, defining how a convention like this would actually function and its capacity to propose either amendments to the Constitution or a replacement of the Constitution with something else. And the very, very reputable authorities on constitutional law who have said to us, don't do this. You don't have any idea what a convention like this will do. Despite all of your all of the things in the memorial, despite all the things in this bill that are intended to limit its effect to a certain thing, they tell us that there is no way to accomplish that. It can't be done. There is another movement going on right now to pass a constitutional amendment that would prevent the federal government from going into debt. Another catastrophe, different catastrophe, but another catastrophe if it were to be approved. Not possible to run a modern economy without the possibility of going into debt when necessary. Can't be done. I need an answer to that question, to the question of how this convention would actually be run, how we would go about limiting its focus, whether or not the calls for convention by states that have asked for a balanced budget amendment would somehow be combined with this one for the purpose of calling a convention. The fact is that I've received a number of assurances from a number of people. Every single one of them rings hollow to me because there is no precedent There is no law. There is no way of actually knowing for sure. And then as a part of this question, I want to take you back to 1789. Or was it 1787? I lose track of the date. Sorry.
I wasn't.
You weren't there. I was. I was there, but I forget the date. That Constitution, that convention was absolutely extra legal. The states sent people to it because of their sense of state sovereignty at the time, but the Constitution that they wrote indicated in its own terms that it would go into effect when a certain number of states ratified it, whereas the Articles of I'm going to blow the name here. The Articles of Confederation, thank you, other people know this history. The Articles of Confederation were very clear that in order to amend them, it required a unanimous decision on the part of the states to do that. So this Constitution that we now operate under went into effect under its own terms before all the states had ratified it in direct violation of the older document. We have precedent, I think very clear precedent, that once a convention like this is called, you can't control it. I want to know why people think otherwise. At this point, even though my name, I think, is on this joint memorial, I'm not prepared to vote for it for the reasons I've indicated. Please explain to me how it is that Professor Tribe and all the others are just wrong.
Chair Williamson, Representative Barnhart, I think I mentioned up front that I'm not a constitutional lawyer. If I didn't, I probably should have prefaced it with that. I do find comfort in the fact that the framers did allow this as an avenue for us. Has it been done before? You're exactly right. No, it hasn't. And for everybody that I've talked to that says you can do this and keep it very narrow, I agree. There are other intelligent constitutional people that say, no, it'll run amok and it'll be expanded and deal with other things. I'm not the guy to answer that. Folks behind me have worked on this a lot longer and deeper than I have. Hopefully they will have something that will make you feel better. Chuck Schechtoff emailed us and said, absolutely not, it'll run amok. But again, I've talked to numerous other experts that say, no, you can have a narrowly targeted amendment convention based on one topic. All I can tell you is I've tried to research it too, and that's what I've come up with.
Let me follow, if I could, just very briefly.
Absolutely.
I don't need to be convinced that we need a constitutional amendment to fix this problem or a new Supreme Court that will come to a different conclusion. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the hearing doesn't need to spend any time on that issue. This is the one that worries me.
So, Chair Williamson and Representative Barnhart, I would agree with my colleague that although I, like him, have done research and feel comfortable with those answers, the people that are here behind us who will come up after us have spent more time doing this and I believe would be in a better position to give you a more thorough answer. So unless there are other questions, I think that having the next panel come up may be more helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Let's do that. So I have Kirk Leonard, Allison Hartson, and Phil Gallucci. Sorry, I was going to slaughter that. Come on up. And for the next panel, I have Colby, Rich, and Rob. So.
Right. Hello. I'm Allison Hartson, a national director of Wolfpack, which is the political arm of the Young Turks, the largest online news show in the world. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for having us here today. We're working with volunteers currently in 40 states to pass resolutions or memorials, as you like to say here, at the state level, calling for an amendment convention to restore free and fair elections in America. We will have at least 25 live resolutions in 2016, and recently passed one in Vermont, California, Illinois, and New Jersey. Because we've already been here for the last several minutes talking about the issue, I will go ahead and get right to the point, as Representative Barnhart was specifically asking. So, Representative Barnhart, you asked specifically about precedent, lack of precedent. But there is, in fact, precedent. HJM 201 calls for an amendment through a limited convention. And here's how we know that a convention can, in fact, be limited to a single subject. It takes two-thirds of the states, 34 states, to pass a resolution calling for an amendment convention on the same issue. Now, since our country's founding, there have been over 700 applications calling for an amendment convention submitted by the states on a variety of subjects. Now, if you could take 10 applications for issue A, 20 applications for issue B, 4 applications for issue C, count them all together, we would have had a convention years ago. But we haven't, because the precedent is clear. You have to have 34 states calling on the same exact issue. Furthermore, there have also been 233 state-level conventions to amend and adapt their state constitutions. This is more precedence that gives, and the fact that these 233 state-level conventions have never run away from their stated purpose, never, not one. This is what gives the authorities, you know, you were talking or asking Representative Barnhart about the reputable authorities. But there are constitutional scholars who actually agree with the Department of Justice and the American Bar Association and the Congressional Research Service that it can, in fact, be limited because of this precedence here. So the same reason that some groups and individuals oppose the convention process is the same reason that I'm for it. It's a democratic process. You get people together from a variety of perspectives, discuss and debate ideas, and then you present that idea to the rest of the population for the ratification process. That's how democracy is supposed to work in this country. Now, every generation of Americans has amended the Constitution except one, and that's ours. And now it's our turn. So let's use the tools that the Founding Fathers provided for us, which I'd like to add that they provided this tool for us in order to be able to amend the Constitution when we can no longer rely on Congress. It is our constitutional right and our duty to use this and to revitalize our republic. So this will be our legacy and our gift to future generations of Americans. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here, for calling this hearing, and for being leaders in the fight for free and fair elections in America. I ask for your favorable vote on HJM 201, and I'm happy, more than happy, to take any questions you may have.
You. Good afternoon, Chair Williamson, Vice Chairs, and committee members. I have a couple of questions that were posed to me, and I thought I would answer them.
Can you identify yourself for the record?
Excuse me, I'm sorry. My name is Kirk Leonard, and I live here in Salem.
Excellent. Thank you.
And I'm a representative of Oregon, Move to Amend. So anyway, on to my two questions. Why are we back after the successful passage of HJM 6 in 2013? Is the first one, and the second one is why did we compromise? We had our own measure last year, as did Wolfpack, and we came together later in the session. Why did we do that? Basically, there's two paths to an amendment. First one was what we did in HJM 6, which is ask Congress for an amendment. In all instances, Congress has written an amendment, whether or not they were being asked for one. Depending on how you count them, and I haven't read the detailed history, but there are some seven or eight that were brought up on a path of a state convention plan. In all instances, the Congress broke and wrote it and submitted it, and luckily many were adopted. The second path is one I suggested, is HJM 201, which is to call for an Article 5 convention. of the states, and the states, by extension, would write an amendment, not depending on Congress for that. Additionally, I mean, it's seen as a stronger statement, and that's why we're here, why we were here last year, why we're here this year, to want to move forward with it. Prior to 2014, additionally, NTA National, Move to Amend National, didn't support a convention call, and so we've been working through the process of understanding what's going on with it ourselves, and have concluded the fear is unrealistic. And unfortunately, I don't have a copy of the document that I wrote, that I submitted. I think it may, I don't know, is it still lost in cyberspace, Aaron? which I sent by email, and somehow it's not shown up. I don't know. I have to call my ISP and see what's going on here. It details a good bit more about why fear of a constitutional convention, an Article 5 convention, is you know, it doesn't hold water. To make it more interesting to you, and I hope it does arrive sooner than later, it'll be online. It's a rebuttal of Sheketov, basically. That said, why did we compromise last year? We came back with the compromise this year, although I have to thank Representative Huffman and Representative Hoyle, because I think there was a little bit of language tweaking that improved it. We had wanted to work with Wolfpack in the beginning, but it just didn't in 2014. It was like ships passing in night in some ways. We were at different phases of organization, different concerns, and it just didn't work. But eventually, we found both bills were stalled, and we were asked to get together and make a compromise. And so we're willing to do that because our motivations are fundamentally the same. We have some detailed differences. Mainly, Move to Amend is really hung up on having campaign finance reform, money of speech, ending money of speech, as well as corporate personhood. And for my Republican friends, whenever we say corporation, unions are there. They are included, as Representative Huffman indicated. They're statutory entities, and that's what we're talking about, is restriction of statutory entities. And what Wolfpack prefers is language that they see by extension to return democracy to the people. And we differed about that for a while, and then eventually we didn't. And you are seeing the result improved by Representative Huffman and Hoyle that we came up with. I urge you to vote for it. Send it to the House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Chair Williamson and members of the committee. My name is Phil Guidotti. I am the Oregon State Director for Wolfpack, and I stand, and the rest of our group stands, in unity with Move to Amend, and we're happy to be doing so. We learned a lot from last year, and we've reconciled, and we are together. I want to thank Allison for her testimony, speaking to precedent of the Article 5 convention call being able to be limited. I'd also like to piggyback on that precedent with some more, including the fact that in 1787, when the convention that created the Constitution was being held, it's really important to remember one thing didn't exist at that point, which was the Constitution. The Constitution didn't exist. Article 5 of the Constitution did not exist. Article 5 is very clearly written. It's, the only power that the Article 5 Convention has is to propose an amendment. And that is what we intend to do with our bill, HJM 201. In addition, looking back at history, another thing most people don't realize is that most amendments to our Constitution actually started with convention applications like HJM 201, the Bill of Rights, four of the last 10 amendments. They all started with the state level convention calls and then were proposed by Congress. Most notably, the 17th Amendment got within one or two states of compelling a convention, and then Congress capitulated, proposing the amendment for the direct election of senators. Historically, if you need an amendment, you call for a convention. In fact, shortly after a similar resolution, HJM 201, passed in Vermont, the chair for the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy, called a hearing for the Udall Amendment, which deals with this issue. In his explanation of why he saw the need to have this hearing, he said, quote, "It is time for Congress to follow the lead of the states and build support for amending the Constitution. Vermont's call for a convention is a separate approach for amending the Constitution that can operate on a parallel track to the congressional approach that we are initiating today. It is my hope that the two efforts can work in tandem to create an even more momentum on this critical issue." That is the chair of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee essentially asking the states, asking you all, for example, to put pressure on Congress by pursuing the convention route on this issue, saying let's have two parallel tracks working together so that we apply the most amount of pressure for reform. I wish I could vote for this memorial today. I feel very confident with the Article 5 convention path. I feel very confident with George Mason, Washington, all the folks back in the day that made this Article 5 possible. And I want to lead with courage if I were to vote, and I know you all will lead with courage too, because this is an issue that's too important to let go any longer. So myself and Wolfpack, Move to Mend, we all urge your yes vote on HJM 201. Thank you.
Excellent. Any questions for this panel? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your appearance. As you well know, we've been kind of doing this dance for a couple of sessions here on this subject.
Yeah.
And you finally got me. But, you know, a lot of that has to do with the diversity of personalities in this country who are calling for an Article 5 convention. You can't put them in one pot and say it's a certain kind of person who wants this. And I think one of the things that helped me make up my mind on this is the fact that it's fair. And I'm convinced it's going to be fair. I think that if we're going to be looking at cutting off large money, it needs to be cut off from the left, the right, and the middle. And that was one of the things that really hooked me this time, and that is that I am not concerned about unfairness here. I don't want to be in the kind of political world where people in my own community say to me, and somewhat embarrassed when they do, you know, I want to support you, but I just have $25, you know. I'd like to go back to a world where $25 really means something and they feel like they're doing something really great. But anymore, it seems like anyone who wants to give $10, $20, or $30 thinks that they're underperforming somehow. And I'd love to go back to a kind of world where that isn't the case anymore. So I have to remind me sometime we're not calling on something as radical here. And it's easy to think that we're talking about doing something radical. But what we're doing is talking about something that the founders, who generally got it right, instituted. And so I think it's important to remember that we can have faith in the founders here and the mechanism that they put together for us. So.
Representative Rayfield.
So I would first note that my name is on the bill, which means I've signed on. Most importantly, I would note that if you look in your OLIS or if your staff has printed out, three of the materials submitted, one of them was from my city and two of them were from my constituents supporting this. So clearly my district is well represented here. But what I did, I did want to, you know, address some concerns that I do have, you know, because I think that there is a reality from an attorney's perspective when you read Article 5. That the way that is drafted, that once the convention is called, I do believe that it would actually open it up to anything, you know, being brought forth at that time. We're calling a convention, despite the fact that you've called it for a specific reason. If you read Article 5, that's not the way that I necessarily look at it. And there's people who feel both sides on this. this. The one thing that I would, if anybody, you know, I think it would be good, as Representative Barnhart had noted, you know, having, you know, some different constitutional perspectives, folks that have studied this a little bit. But, you know, the where I get a little bit of comfort is in the ratification process. And that is where, even if you did have something, you know, where we did get off the rails, right, which I think if we look at our national politics right now, I think it's pretty easy to get off the rails. I think we can all agree with that, no matter where you are. And so, do you guys want to talk about the ratification process in the Article 5?
Right, yeah. So the ratification process is the same whether or not you have Congress or the states write the amendment. So it's 38 states, two-thirds, and that means that nothing too far left or too far right is ever going to be approved by that high of a threshold. In fact, we have one of the most rigid constitutions in history to amend because of that high ratification threshold, not just at the ratification level, but also to even get to convene the convention itself at two-thirds of the states. So that's really important to remember. You know, you've got there are absolutely at least 13 legislative chambers that are blue, 13 legislative chambers that are red. It takes one of them to stop the ratification of anything that is too far left or too right. And I guess that really just answers your question, right? Yeah.
One follow-up I did have is the other concern that I have with this is like legal challenges. So if we were to get in there, and then how does this drag out? Because this actually is something as you play through this, right? So if we have folks on one side of an issue, folks on another side, and then we get legal challenges to things along the way, have you guys thought about those complexities?
About if it were to open up?
Yeah, or if it were to open up, or, you know, and we start going into where different amendments are being proposed and things like that, and
right.
The potential, I mean, well, quite frankly, from both sides of the fence, folks wanting to open it up or folks maybe not wanting to open it up, that would work.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to let you know is that's actually in this memorial itself, that the delegates would be mandated by the wishes of their state to stick to that actual subject. And there actually is, I mean, while we haven't technically had a national Article 5 convention, we've had conventions throughout our history at the state level. We have the Electoral College, and those delegates, by and large, stick to the mandates of their state and can be recalled as well. So there actually is not just historical precedents, as we've already listed here, but there's even legal precedents that you can, in fact, make it so that the delegates are mandated by the wishes of their state in the resolution or in the memorial, should you state it, and ours actually does here. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's somewhat helpful.
Okay,
go ahead.
I have a response that is relevant, I believe, to Representative Rayfield's question and Representative Barnhart's concern. One of the points that I make in the longer piece that I have submitted is that Congress has to be involved in both of these, either way, when you read Article 5. With respect to something going, you know, out of control, Congress is as worried about that as anybody, I'm sure. Historically, that's why they've capitulated on what would have been state convention amendments each time. And they would have to affect implementing legislation to make the convention happen, right? And there's nothing that prevents them in their implementing legislation from providing a way to pull the plug if they thought things were going too strangely. So I just want to make the point that the only difference between the two methods is who's writing it. Not the process, not anything having to do with it. I mean, there aren't rules Congress can figure it out. Congress can do an amendment, but there's nobody that decided how Congress would do that. That's not in the Constitution either. It's up to the Congress to figure out how they want to organize that stuff. And they're involved with the whole process no matter which way it goes. And I would argue that they could do implementing legislation that would pull the plug if they felt that was a need.
Chair Williamson, if I may, Representative Rayfield and the rest of the members of the committee. I'd like to just take a moment to recognize, so 3/4 of the states for ratification, we're talking, so if you had 13, all you need was 13 state legislatures disagreeing with what came out of this to be able to overturn whatever came out of the convention or proposed by Congress or whatever it may be in the ratification process. So if you imagine the 13 reddest states that we have and the 13 bluest states that we have, we all know that there's plenty of blue and plenty of red on both sides, so that the ratification process it's going to absolutely require that only the most populist and most broad-based supported solutions are ever going to have a chance to get through. The ratification bar is just too high for anything partisan or anything scary or anything to get through. So it gives me comfort.
I want to just say really quick, I understand that a large part of the question, and I think this comes back to what you're referring to, is the rules. What will the rules of the convention be? And I want to make sure it's clear that there has never been a convention ever in our history that started without determining what the rules are going to be. That's just logical, obviously, let alone historical precedence there. So that will be determined, including how you are able to make sure that the delegates are held responsible to the wishes of their state. And that's why Wolfpack is coordinating nationwide to make sure that the resolutions are viable, legally viable. We work with constitutional scholars. We work with legal experts in order to make sure that happens, because we understand and believe in how important it is that it is a limited convention.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. A different question than the one, and I really appreciate the responses to the one I raised earlier. I think you may have answered this, but I want to be certain that I understand. As I understand it, the process and membership even of a convention is not self-executing. Somebody's got to decide how the convention's going to be called, who's eligible to attend, how they're chosen, how a resolution from the convention would be adopted, or is it vote by states? Is it vote by individual members? Is it based on population? Is it based on the fact that there are 50 states and each state gets a vote? How would it be done? I assume that all has to be decided by somebody. Is there guidance in the Constitution about that? If there isn't, what's Wolfpack's approach? How would you see it happening? I'm positing, for example, Congress does its normal dilatory behavior these days and doesn't pass a bill for 10 years. What do you do?
Yeah, well, there definitely is precedence for that as well. And in this memorial itself, it states that basically the delegates themselves would either be appointed or elected state officials or locally elected officials, but it would exclude Congress, current sitting members of Congress, or any congressional members from the past as well, okay? So that's who the delegates would be according to this. And as far as whether or not they would be appointed or whether or not it would be by a special election, there's precedence that the states would be able to choose what that would be. Now, as far as establishing what those rules are, again, that would be something that would likely be established. It would definitely be established right before the convention. As I was saying, no convention has ever began without having rules established first. But Orrin Hatch in the 1980s wrote a bill in order to describe what the rules would be, and it went through, it was reintroduced like 2 or 3 times. And it never actually ended up passing because this was during when the balanced budget amendment resolution started getting up there into the 20s, and they were seeing the writing on the wall, we're going to have an Article 5 convention. So at the congressional level, they started writing a bill for what those rules would be. They stopped doing it. They started rescinding some of those resolutions, and now they're moving forward again. So that there shows us that, yes, they would start coming together to talk about those rules, as he was saying, maybe at the congressional level, but we also have a state convention coming together right now called the Assembly of State Legislators. And it's a bipartisan convention of state legislators around the nation who are writing the rules to address exactly a lot of the questions that you're asking, Representative Barnhart. And then you've got, you know, Mason's rules. You guys know about Mason's handbook. That is a very long book and a lot of laws there of precedence of most likely the rules that they would be adhering to. Does that help answer your question?
I think so. And I would note that the resolution does contain, on page 2, lines, probably 5 through about 14, some descriptions of what Oregon would like to do. And simply one simple change in what you said, if this resolution passes, the individuals could not be people who are elected or appointed to federal office now or in the past.
Right.
The people who are in, but still, it leaves completely open the idea of how voting gets done, or even the selection process. I mean, it proposes in the alternative, current elected to state and local office, or selected by election in each congressional district. Mm-hmm. It's pretty vague.
Right. And that is so that the state legislature at the time that the convention convenes, I believe that legally that's why it is, so that the state legislature at that time can decide.
I'm going to go ahead and ask the second panel to come up because we only have about 20 more minutes.
Okay. And I apologize.
No, it's okay. I just want to make sure that the second panel has ample time. So Colby, Rich, and Rob, come on down. Yeah, careful of those chairs. They're squirrely. Go ahead.
Yeah.
And then when you grab the drawer, it's a mess.
But it's not just me. Thank you, Chairwoman, members of the committee, for allowing me to speak today. I will skip over the parts of my speech that go into the ratification process, as we've now covered that. So my name is Colby Clipston, and I'm an Oregonian. One of the values I was raised with was to always stand up for what I believe is right and try to make the change that I want to see in the world. During my time at U of O studying political science, this value was my main motivation because I truly wanted to help change the world for the better, and that's exactly why I'm here today. In fact, I think that's why we're all here today. I'd even, you know, venture a guess that that's a big reason why a lot of you on this committee decided to run. This memorial, HJM 201, is an opportunity to change our country and ultimately the world for the better. From conservative Republicans to progressive Democrats, Americans agree on the need to restore free and fair elections in America. This is not an issue of right versus left. This is an issue of right versus wrong. Americans are deeply concerned that our representative democracy is in jeopardy when dark money flows uninterrupted into our political process, obscuring the will of the people. But what shall we do? At the original convention in Philadelphia, General Mason stood up and asked about the amendment process. What shall we do if Congress itself is the problem? And that is why the convention procedure utilized in HJM 201 was added to the Constitution. On this vital American issue, it is time for Oregon to lead, using the powers built into the Constitution by the Founding Fathers for this very purpose. If Congress itself is the source of the problem, then it is the duty and responsibility of the states to take action to fix it. Please vote yes on HJM 201 so that we can utilize this process that has historically resulted in amending the Constitution and make America a more perfect union. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Richard Harrisay. I'm a co-founder of Move to Amend in this area, Marion Polk Move to Amend. and I'm active in the national organization. I serve on a national committee. I'm in touch with the leaders of the Move to Amend National Movement quite frequently. And we have discussed the Article 5 problem a number of times. I'd like to give you my presentation here and then address some of the problems with the Article 5 convention. I'd like to start with a quote, which you may recognize. "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure." That was Thomas Jefferson. He wrote that when he was in Paris and had just been presented with a copy of the new Constitution and news of the Shays' rebellion. And he was happy for the rebellion. He thought it should occur, actually probably every 20 years. Later in life, he concluded that a rebellion was still necessary, but that bloodshed was not, since the people through the states now had recourse to challenge a non-responsive or abusive Congress through the Article 5 Convention, which I'll refer to as AVC. He applied this remedy to abuses by both the executive and judicial branches as well. Just because some other faction recognizes the power of the AVC is all the more reason that we should be present when it's actually implemented. The AVC had been argued for in the convention to placate the vehement anti-federalist and as instrumental in eventually gaining some of their cooperation. Real opposition, however, was mounted during the ratification process. It was during this time that Madison expressed his opposition to a second convention before ratification. This fact, often misquoted and misapplied, has been used to support opposition to AVCs, when Madison, in fact, in other writings, was not opposed to the general concept. In fact, this had nothing to do with AVCs. The Constitution was not enacted yet, and so it was all about taking this convention they had just had and doing it over again, because anti-federalists were not very happy with some of the results, and the main thing was that it had no Bill of Rights. Also, the so-called runaway convention is a myth invented and perpetuated by those who own Congress to protect their investment therein. There is a book on this. If you want to look it up, it's excellent, and it's in the long version of my speech here, and it's by Paul J. Weber and Barbara Perry, called Unfounded Fears, 1989. This was as a result of and in conjunction with the Bicentennial and as a result of the balanced budget amendment, essentially. Alexander Hamilton wrote the following in Federalist Paper number 85. "The words of this article are peremptory. The Congress," quote, Hamilton liked to use air quotes, "shall call a convention." I was there too. "Nothing in this particular is left to the discretion of that body. This Article 5 convention is meant to circumvent Congress, because they are not doing what the people need done." The convention has Congress has no authority beyond calling the convention and setting up the ratification process. That's it. And this is why the wording is so sparse. It says shall. It imposes a duty, a chore, if you will, and it is not something that they have any say in. And Hamilton, and you'll see in the longer quote in the paper, Hamilton has a lot to say about this. Basically, that they have no say, that now once the thing is called, it's in the state's hands. The states set the rules. The states set up the entire thing. The convention itself will write its own rules. And I would like to see, in fact, I would like to see an amendment proposed that says how these conventions are to be run in fairly general language, but still a lot more than we have now. So it's something that is, yeah, it has people tearing their hair out. But it's also a first thing, like George Washington was the first president. Well, he set the example of a two-term presidency, which wasn't broken until FDR. You know, there were a lot of things. In fact, that wasn't the only thing that Washington set as an example. But this here, we are in a position now to set the example for how Article 5 conventions are to be run. I would like to see included in some of these proposals for the convention a statement that says, okay, part of the amendments that we want is an amendment which states how these conventions are to be run. And that would be the first order of business when the convention convened. That's me.
All right. Thank you.
Chair Williamson, Vice Chairs Gilliam and Hoyle, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. I am Bob Osertich, co-founder of the Corvallis Area Move to Amend affiliate. If the Oregon Constitution is amended by HJR 205, it would be a good thing for Oregon, but it would only bring your ability to rein in direct candidate campaign contributions up to the level of federal candidates. You, like your federal counterparts, would still be constrained by the Supreme Court's decision in Buckley v. Vallejo. Yes, you will try to apply their test. Is the level of spending we propose corrupting or have the appearance of corruption? Regardless, the Supreme Court's view of money as a speech right and the place of corporations in campaigns would remain. You will have wealthy individuals lobbying to increase any limits you may be considering, and so too will corporate lobbyists with even higher demands, because they too are considered persons with a right to speak as loud as they can afford. From the Article 5 Constitutional Convention that HJM 201 proposes could come the amendment you had endorsed in HJM 6 in 2013. This convention would not merely address campaign finance reform, but could fully return the dependency of our elected officials to the people alone, as Madison would have. Currently, this dependency is on those who are able to spend excessively in elections because of decisions of the nation's highest court, both long before and after the infamous Citizens United decision. These are decisions that gave artificial entities personhood and proclaimed that money was political speech. The resulting laws and policies can only be overturned for all time by a constitutional amendment. These Supreme Court decisions that HJM 201 convention would ultimately address to return the people to choose political leadership, write our own laws, and determine the fate of our state without the undue influence of all those who can spend excessively. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Questions? No. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 201. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4129.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have received the fiscal impact on the Dash 1 amendment for House Bill 4129. The fiscal impact does indicate that the measure does need to go to Ways and Means. There is not currently a subsequent referral on that, so we will be asking in our recommendation upon adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to add a referral to Ways and Means, and we have been given permission from the Speaker's office to do that.
Madam Chair, before I make a motion, I wanted to say something on record about this bill. I think it's important to note that Ledge Counsel is correct. There's nothing in this bill that precludes public money. I would just point out it's important that the bill also points toward, encourages private money. I mentioned this earlier. My hope is that zero public funds will go. Technically, Ledge Counsel is correct, but I wanted that clarification. And with that, I'll make a motion.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4129.
We need to amend it first.
Thank you. My mistake. Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 4129.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Gilliam has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 4129. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion carries.
Madam Chair, I now move House Bill 4129 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and that the measure be referred to Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved House Bill 4129 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the measure be referred to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion carries. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 4129.
Madam Chair, Ms. McKinney, I believe that completes our work today. We will not be here on Friday, and we'll be back Monday.
All right, with that, we are adjourned.
My heart. Oh. Wow. Good.